General Pike, real one. What job were you doing, General Pike, when the Korean War broke out in June 1950?
I was the deputy director of military operations at the War Office. Naturally, the invasion of Korea brought great interest, great activity. The basic problem was to what extent we should help the Koreans and the Americans, and there were great discussions about it. We were, at that time, as ever, very pressed militarily. We had troops deployed all over the world, and the official War Office line was that we are so stretched that we can't really do anything about it. However, the CIGS, General Sir William Slim, thought very differently. He said at once, we've got to do something, and saw to it that we did. And of course the first thing we did was to send off very quickly the 27th Brigade from Hong Kong. They were very much a scratch formation, gathered together on the cheap. They were not well equipped with all the sort of better things and the better equipment. But off they went, and of course they fought a fine battle and did remarkably well. But that you will hear about from other people, because I was not there. The next problem was whether we should do something more. Here again, Bill Slim was determined that we must play our part, and we therefore set up the 29th Brigade Group, which was extensively organized, well equipped, and dispatched towards the end of the year. It was a fine brigade group. We might call that the Rolls-Royce Brigade Group, whereas 27th Brigade was the Woolworth Brigade Group. Then, of course, the Canadians came in, and the Australians wished to send a battalion, the New Zealanders a field regiment, and so on. And so I was there in the War Office when all this organization and dispatch of those troops to Korea were organized and dispatched. The whole idea of a Commonwealth division was really rather a romantic one. It was a great bit of idealism, and I thought that there would be nothing I should like to do better than to go as CRA of the artillery. I volunteered to do so, and to my intense delight, I was accepted, and I therefore got out of the War Office and into this wonderful operational command. The divisional commander appointed was Jim Castles, who was a very old friend of mine and a very great commander. He was in Australia, and so we flew independently out to Japan, where we met. And we then did a visit to Korea, saw the lie of the land, and made all the preliminary steps towards setting up of the division. In the meantime, the C elements of divisional headquarters, headquarters RA, were coming out by sea. And they, as far as the artillery was concerned, they came out under the brigade major, Major Paddy Victory. They arrived in Busan, and I think somewhere about May, early June. They disembarked, and we then marched up as a divisional headquarters, Royal Artillery. We marched up from Busan up to Seoul and north of Seoul to the deployment area, which was just south of the river Incheon.
Approximately when would this have been?
I said just now the Incheon River, which was a slip of the tongue. Incheon was the place of the American landings, the Imjin River. We arrived, the headquarters RA arrived on the 24th of June at Busan, and on the 15th of July we moved up, exercising ourselves and having a tactical exercise on the way, and on the 20th, and we became operational on the 28th of July. The Americans had organized the concentration of 29th Brigade, 28th Brigade, and the Canadian Brigades, and we all concentrated together in this area south of the Indian River.
Which year was this?
1951.
You said that it was a wonderful command for you. Why did you consider it so wonderful?
Well, of course, the idea of the Commonwealth Division, it sort of hit people as being an idealist formation. It got together all the countries of the Commonwealth. We're all devoted to each other. So everybody felt that this was really something rather special. They felt, first of all, that they had to cooperate together to make the show of success. Also, they were not going to have anybody else doing anything better than they did. So there was tremendous competition as between the UK, Canadian, New Zealand, Australians, and so on, as to no one was going to allow anybody else to do anything better than they did. So there was this tremendous sense of competition, at the same time, tremendous cooperation for this superb division, and it was a superb idea, and it turned into a superb division. But it was very uneconomic. We had so many differences. We had different legal systems. After all these national detachments were responsible to different independent governments. We had different equipments in some cases. We all had the same gun, but we had many of our vehicles and many of our bits of equipment were different. We dressed differently, our clothes were very often different. And so it was a very expensive division to run administratively and gave many headaches. But on the other side, from the point of view of morale and getting the Kenworth together and having a superb division, it couldn't have been bettered. So those were the pros and cons, really, of it. And it was a magnificent division. And, of course, we had a superb divisional commander and a lot of very good brigade commanders. And so it was a superbly organized and commanded division.
When you first arrived in Korea, what kind of impression did the country make on you?
Well, of course, it's what one expected. It was, although we were not deployed in the most mountainous part, it was a lot of very steep, rocky hills, and to get to the top of one and to go to another, you almost always had to come down into a valley. Why ours was less mountainous was because it was the position of honor, because it was the easiest area for an invading army from the north, and therefore it was the place where one was liable to have the most likely attacks coming in, and that's where we were. It's a beautiful country. We were there then, the spring was just ending, full of spring flowers. A very hot summer ends very quickly with a tremendous rains and floods. I mean, at one occasion the Imjin River rose 30 or 40 feet in a matter of a couple of hours. Tremendous floods when the rains came. And then in the autumn it started to die off, and then you've got all the most beautiful wild flowers, azaleas, rhododendrons, all sorts of beautiful, then a scrub oak in the autumn. And so the hills were really lovely, and then you've got the first signs of the frost. The hills were the most beautiful colours. The trees going golden colours, another magnificent sight. And then, of course, about December, the cold came seriously. Anyone would have frost and snow. And then the whole of the winter. And the winter was exceedingly cold, which made things like patrolling very difficult, because if you wanted to avoid getting your frostbite on your ears, then you had to wear something over them. On the other hand, if you did, you couldn't hear properly. Your metal on the guns, for instance, if you touched them with bare hands, it would stick to it. Believe it or not, that the difference in a range was simply enormously affected by the weather. Under normal conditions, so we say normal temperature, no wind and so on, if the shell would go, shall we say, 8,000 yards, it would be plus or minus of over 1,000 yards, and occasionally as much as 1,500 yards difference. So that in adjusting your artillery fire, you, especially at night, you had to take account of this intense cold and the enormous effect it had on the range of your shells where they went. And of course clothing was an enormous factor. But one felt very fit in the cold weather, in the frosty weather. It was like champagne air. The only tiresome time was when the temperature rose and we had snow. Then it would become slushy and beastly and horrible for a bit, but then once it came back to the hard frost, then of course it was very much easier, although very much colder. Occasionally you had this frightful northern wind from Manchuria. That was simply bitter. And then, of course, towards the, as the spring started, the thaw came in, and it was an extraordinary sight, because you could see the water bubbling up in these tracks. The most extraordinary sight. Because, of course, when we arrived, there were practically no roads in Korea. There were a certain number of tracks, but wherever we went as a division, we had to bulldoze out and make our own roads. Our sappers became absolute experts at that. I mean, the reconnaissance of our first lot of guns, once we advanced, to reconnoiter gun positions, I used to do it in a helicopter and choose the gun positions where we wanted to go. And then the sappers would bulldoze through a track so we could get there. We'd get the guns there, and then subsequently they would metal the tracks and make them so we could bring up ammunition at a certain degree of efficiency. And so we did, the division built up a network of tolerably good roads wherever they went.
When you got there, I presume that the war of movement was more or less over.
It wasn't quite over. We were deployed behind the River Imjin. The Chinese, I suppose, were 3,000 or 4,000 yards north of that, We used to patrol across the river, and the Americans were anxious we should, United Nations command, that we should push them further back. And so the first operation we did was we did a reconnaissance in force raid across the river with one brigade, and we then left it there. And we then brought up the other brigades and brought them, of course. Of course, one had, there were no bridges. We subsequently built bridges, but we had ordinary boats and ferries, and that's where we got across. And we pushed the Chinese back. There was not great difficulty in that. But then we had, in October, a major operation which was called Operation Commando. The raid before that was Operation Minden 8, which was the 8th to the 12th of September. And that was a raid across which we subsequently left the battalions across, and we did an advance across the river with the remaining brigades and battalions. We then had to get the guns across the river, and this is when there were no roads and tracks, and this is when I had to do a recce of that area by helicopter. We got the guns across. The sappers bulldozed tracks for us to get the guns in position, and subsequently, as I've just explained, they turned those into quite reasonable metalled roads. The next major operation, and the last mobile operation, was, as I've said, Commando, and that was the 3rd to the 18th, to the 3rd to the 8th of October. It took us a week. This was a very spirited battle, which took us a week. The Americans on our right took several weeks to gain their equivalent objectives. As far as I remember, something like 800 or 900 casualties, whereas the Americans had many times greater casualties. It was a very successful operation. There was some very severe fighting. We got all our objectives except one. There were various attacks and counterattacks, and eventually we settled down on a new line, having given the Chinese a fairly bloody nose. I'm sure you'll appreciate that on our front we had the Chinese the whole time. The North Koreans were further to the east. We always had the Chinese. And the Chinese was a very stout basic soldier. I have a lot of admiration for them. They fought well, they dug magnificently, and they were a very redoubtable enemy. Anyway, we established ourselves on these new hill features. I had to bring the guns forward and again recce new positions, again have the tracks bulldozed to them, and we settled down for the best part of a month. About a month later, it was actually around Guy Fawkes Day, we had a very serious attack by the Chinese. General Castles was away on leave, and so I was in commanding the division at that time. This was a very heavy fighting. The artillery did magnificent work. especially with the ROP. The ROPs would see these attacks, which nearly always came in the evening. This was the time when the sun was in our eyes, which was, of course, a great help to them. They liked to come in about an hour before dark, and incidentally, that was a time when our radio was the most difficult conditions. We got a lot of interference, and atmospheric interference at that time, but nevertheless, we always kept our radio going. And the artillery did superb work. First of all, ROPs directing our fire, and then firing our defensive tasks through our forward observing officers and so on. There was KOSB, of course, had their particularly tough battle when Private Speakman won his VC. There were a lot of awards for gallantry in this time, and it was really no mean battle. They knocked us off two hills, I think. We recaptured one, and we retained the main bastion, which was a hill called 355, and we never lost 355, which was the main feature we had captured in Operation Commando, and this we never lost. But there, we were knocked off a tiresome hill called 217, another, I think, called 227, and we never got back onto 217.
You mentioned your admiration for certain qualities of the Chinese. Did they have any weaknesses, would you say?
They were... in the set battles which then happened, when the war then stabilized, and of course they dug extremely well, they fought tenaciously, and were a match for us in that static warfare. Indeed, our patrolling in many ways may have been better than ours. They were very good on that, but if the war had opened out and we'd had mobile warfare, then I think we should have been all over them. If the United Nations had wished to do so politically and produced a corps and put through a corps attack, I'm quite sure we'd have had a very tough few days fighting. We'd have broken through, and once we'd got the Chinese on the run, we would have been more than a match for them, because our soldiers have a better education, more initiative, and I'm sure we'd have had a very successful operation. I was always surprised that we never did that, but the whole operations were so befogged by politics, and of course at that time the armistice talks were continuing. They had started at what's the name of the place?
Panmunjom.
They started Panmunjom, and they were going on. And there was a great tussle, I imagine, politically. On one side, the Koreans in particular wanted to have as much real estate as they could, because I think they thought that when the thing was finally signed, they would more or less keep what they had got. And so they were all out to try and take as much territory as they could. On the other hand, from our point of view, an extra hill or so, or extra area or so, didn't seem to justify the enormous casualties which we'd have involved. And we had, especially the Commonwealth Division, we had great responsibilities to not only our own government in the UK, but also to the Canadian, New Zealand, Australian, and all the other governments. And we were very anxious not to get unnecessary casualties. The Americans were less sensitive to casualties than we were, and very often we had arguments with them as to whether certain operations were really necessary. At one time, for instance, the American or United Nations command view was that we had so much better firepower and the Chinese had the numbers, and so we should try and get the Chinese to attack and we would then decimate them with our superior firepower. The best way, they argued, to do that was to advance and capture certain hill features which stuck out, and this would invite the Chinese to counterattack when we could when we could then flay them with all our weapons from ground and air. And this, they started to do this, and of course you would capture this hill, quite a lot of casualties to get there. We would then stay, the Chinese would put in the counterattack. Inevitably, they probably succeeded and pushed us off what was not tactically a very suitable place from our point of view. And then the Americans tended to say, well, no goddamn Chinese is going to throw us off this hill, and back they'd go. And so you would then get a ding-dong battle going for a hill feature which was not really of particular value to anybody, least of all to us. That was a shows you the slightly differing outlook between us and them. We, the whole time, were very sensitive about not incurring unnecessary casualties. I think the Americans took a rather tougher line on that, and certainly the Koreans did.
Why do you think the Americans took this tougher line than the Commonwealth?
I think they are, in many ways, have a tougher outlook than we do. They are a great country and a great race, and very proud of being American, and I think they perhaps have a more Germanic outlook on things military than we do. I've always thought that. And after all, there are no finer soldiers than the Germans. I mean, the German army is a tremendous machine. And I suppose there's no finer army in the world than the German army at its best. And they have that outlook. I think they have a bigger, greater sense of aggressiveness than we have. I think ours comes from World War I, because we were all brought up in my young days of the terrible casualties in World War I, and many of them we are always told were unnecessary. And so I think we have always been, since World War I, very sensitive to unnecessary casualties. I think in World War II we were better probably than the Americans in conserving casualties.
Were there any differences between the Commonwealth forces and the Americans from the point of view of techniques?
Yes. Again, the Americans always do things big. If they're making a plan to, shall we say, attack and capture a certain area, down at Army headquarters, Corps headquarters, the planners make a plan and put various alternatives to the general, and the general decides which. The orders are issued, and then in they go. And they don't spare. If they think they need, shall we say, two divisions, then they'll probably put in four. They'll make sure that the equipment all the equipment needed, all the stores are there. Many of them, they over-insure in that way, but by doing it, they probably ensure success. On the other hand, our technique is, if we are going to